Okay, folks, pick up the presentation if you haven't picked it up. It's right in front. But it'll also be online, so I know two slides might be a little tough to read, some of the slides on one page, but I'll put the single slide up online. So I got your summaries. Thank you for sending them. I actually bundled together both the summaries you sent me and the summaries sent by the morning MBA, the MBA class in the morning. So are the 600 people in two classes put together? I think I got about 500 summaries, so it's pretty good. There were some which were incomplete, so I did not include them. I've actually put up the entire summary list up online, so you can download all 500 companies, take a look at what you find. But what I thought I'd do today is take you on a magical mystery tour of the entire class, using the numbers you sent me as my vehicle for revisiting things you might not want to revisit. Okay? So you remember, go back 28 sessions, end of January when we started this class, I described this as an applied corporate finance class. Okay? And I told you then, it was a threat and a promise. I said, you're going to pick a company and you're going to use that company to learn everything you need to learn about corporate finance. And I said, this company will become your vehicle for facing all the things that you might have trouble with in your class. The first time I taught corporate finance in 1984, I was asked to use a case in my class. And it's the first and only time I've ever used a case in my class, because to me, using a case is an admission of failure. Why? Because a case is set in the past, somebody writes the story of the case, and then you work. It's like being in a drama where everything is scripted, you know how the game's going to end. And that seems like a pity when, in fact, the real world is full of surprises. Some of these surprises were not that pleasant. So let me review some of the things you probably ran into in the course of your project, and you tell me whether this is, in fact, a good way to describe what you found. The first is, I don't know whether you noticed, but there are very few facts on the ground, right? Even the things you took for facts after you dug a little discovered weren't facts. Like what? I mean, even the numbers you thought were given, like the risk-free rate, kept shifting on you. And if you thought about accounting numbers as facts before this class, hopefully you've let go of that illusion, because you checked out the operating income for your company on your 10K, it was different from what you saw on Capital IQ, which was different from what you saw on Yahoo Finance, and you had to make choices. Get used to it. That's the way the world is. There are very few facts, lots of unknowns. The second one is that the real world is a messy place. Messy in what sense? Nothing ends in three zeros. Have you noticed that? Only in practice problems can I say the debt is $5 billion, five followed by three zeros. In the real world, there seem to be decimals with everything. That's the way it is. You know, you can fight it, but that's what it is. And the second thing you probably realized is the company you picked in January might bear only a vague resemblance to the company you are looking at today. For instance, many of you, in fact, if you took my advice at the start of the semester, I said, pick companies that are making money. A dozen of you chose to ignore my advice and then came to me crying in the middle of the semester, and I kind of held your hands. I shouldn't have, and let you get through it. But if you picked a money-losing company, you picked a money... But some of you picked money-making companies in January. And by the time you got to May, those companies were losing money. Nothing you can do. Or you picked a company that was acquired during the course of the semester. At least three companies in this class during the course of the semester were acquired. You still had to hang in there and do your analysis, because the acquisition will take a few months to work out. And it might actually make your analysis more interesting to see why your company was targeted. Some of your CEOs lost their jobs during the 5 months. I think it makes it exciting, but it does make things a lot more shaky, because just when you finish section one with corporate governance, there goes your CEO. The CEO you spent half your section one talking about, he's out of the door. Okay? The third, and this should go without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway. Those models you used, those spreadsheets that I gave you, did not commit the carnage that you thought they did. So I'll give you a couple of examples of how these things played out. You'd be working on the optimal debt ratio, and you'd send me an email. So I'm using your spreadsheet that kind of lays the foundation for what's coming. And your spreadsheet, the your is underlined, but it's kind of, it's not underlined, but I can see the underlying. Your spreadsheet gives me an optimal debt ratio of zero for my company. And then the rest was kind of left unsaid. What's wrong with your spreadsheet? Or you value the company and your value is one third of the market price. And you say, your valuation model valued the company at one third. What's going on here? These are spreadsheets. They're inanimate objects. They're actually doing nothing magical. In fact, let me take the valuation spreadsheet. What do? I take your historical data, which you gave me. I ask you for revenue growth, margin, and sales to capital ratio, which you gave me. I project numbers on numbers you gave me. I estimate a value based on numbers you gave me. And you don't like the value. Guess what? You don't like your numbers. And if you don't like your numbers, it's not my problem. You've got to go fix your revenue growth, your margins, your sales to capital ratio. Because spreadsheets don't value companies. They don't give you the optimal debt ratio. And I know when you first start working with these spreadsheets, they take on a life of their own. They seem more powerful than they really are. But you have to recognize that all they are is transmitting what you're assuming about the company. And finally, thing you probably noticed is, yes, I think it was Friday evening, I get an email from somebody saying, I finished my project, but my company just filed its 10Q. What did I say? Use the last 12 months. So the question was, do you want me to redo the numbers with the last 12 months? And my response is, do I look that sadistic to you? But if this were a real-world analysis and you were putting real money behind your valuation, my suggestion is you should update the numbers. Okay? For the purposes of this project, I can understand you've got to finish the project at some point in time, but the thing you notice, it's like nailing Jell-O to a wall. Have you noticed this? You think you got it nailed, but it keeps flopping to the ground. That's exactly what this project will feel like. You think you're done, but then everything kind of reopens. In fact, one thing I would suggest you take out of this project as a long-term part of feedback is think of all those inputs you kept using over and over again. Things like risk-free rate, risk premium, operating income, revenues. They get used in like a dozen places over and over again, right? What I've discovered helps me a lot is to have a master input page with all these inputs. And then have all the spreadsheets connect to the master input page. That way, if I get a 10Q on Friday at 5 o'clock, I'm not going in and entering the numbers into 11 different spreadsheets. I update my master input page. In fact, if you're really lazy, you could actually link the master input page directly to Yahoo Finance and have it update for you. How magical would that be to have your numbers get updated in the background? So try to never hard code a number into a cell. Because once you do that, only you can change it. It's stuck there. So as best as you can, when you build models, try to separate your inputs from everything else. You have the option of changing them. So let's go back to the very beginning. We spent the first three or four sessions of this class talking about corporate governance, which is a fancy way of looking at conflicts of interest between different groups in a corporation. We broke down four linkages. We talked about stockholders having little or no power over managers, because the two mechanisms that stockholders have available to them, the annual meeting and the board of directors, are not that effective at keeping managers in line. And we talked about how managers often put their interests over stockholder interests. We talked about lenders lending money to a company, and if they don't protect themselves, getting Nabisco'd. Remember that? Nabisco'd basically when you lend money to somebody just because they have a big reputation and then they take you to the cleaners. We talked about how companies reveal or hold back information from markets. And many of you noticed this when you started doing your valuations and you started looking for things like, where do you get your revenues? And your company said, 71% of the US, 29% of the rest of the world. And you felt like slapping the company around the face and saying, wake up and just give me the actual numbers. That's something that plays out over and over again, is companies don't always reveal the information they should to markets. And markets do some strange things. You probably, on your company, noticed there were days in the last 4 months where your stock price dropped 7% or 10% or 15% a day. There was no good reason for it. And finally, we talked about social costs and social benefits. But that's the one part of the class I never came back to. I said that every decision creates social costs and social benefits, but I'm going to turn this back to you, and here's why. Social costs and social benefits, by definition, are not just subjective, they're personal. What I mean by that is what you think is important is going to drive what you see as big social costs. If you're an environmentalist, the environmental cost will be the big social cost to you. If you're concerned about labor, it's a labor cost that'll be the. So you have to decide what your social costs and social benefits are. It's not my job and it's not my prerogative to come in and say these are the big social costs, you should factor them in. So that's why I left them off the table. Not because they don't matter, but it's something you will have to confront for yourself as you make decisions. So one of the first things I asked you was, in your company, where does the power lie? And I gave you three choices, right? I said zero if you have no power in stockholders, one if you have some power as stockholders, two if you have lots of power as stockholders. So here's what you told me. So this is, from this point on, when you see a graph, these are your numbers. They come with those disclosure things you see from investment bank emails. That is, if there's a problem with this graph, it's not my fault. These are your numbers. So here's what you told me across your 500 companies. 33, one in three companies, you said stockholders have no power. In 42% of the companies, you said stockholders have some power. In 23% of the companies, you said stockholders have lots of power. And then you started to go to numbers I hadn't even mentioned, like 3, 4, 5, 11, 15. This might be you at 4 o'clock in the morning being very tired and entering numbers that I didn't ask for. Or you have come up with this new corporate governance score that I'm just fascinated to see how you describe in your project. So I've kind of put them in that little sliver of 2% of either you are too exhausted to enter a number, or you've devised this incredibly complex numbering system I don't quite understand, right? But among, you can see how much the power distribution varies across companies. Now, this I did not ask you because I really will find out once you turn over your project. But every semester when I grade projects, one of the questions, and this is one of the questions I asked you, is the marginal investor in your company an institutional investor, an individual investor, or an insider? Why do I care? Why does it matter to me who the marginal investor is? I'm sorry? And whether they're diversified, finish the story. If they're diversified, what does it mean for me? Of risk. Basically, the reason I care whether an investor is institutional is if an institutional investor is likely to be diversified, I can use betas, or any of the models. If the investor is not an institutional investor, if it's an individual, it's a tougher task. I have to ask, is the individual diversified? And there's a chance that the individual might not be diversified. And if it's an insider, I might as well give in, because an insider is almost never going to be diversified. So here's what the breakdown looked like in September of 2015. And I wouldn't be surprised, I'm sorry, the fall of 2000, spring of 2015. I wouldn't be surprised if your numbers look very similar. First, I broke down small and large firms. Among small firms, about 66% of firms, the marginal investor is institutional. About 16% is individual, and about 18% is insider. Larger firms have a far higher percentage of institutional investors being diversified. And that should come as no surprise, because larger firms, in terms of market cap, it gets much more difficult for an individual or insider to be the marginal investor. So small versus large, with small companies, you're far more likely to see individuals or insiders. With larger companies, but with both, institutional investors still dominate. Then I broke down based on geography, US, European, and emerging markets. And emerging market companies have a far higher proportion of insider and individual investors being marginal investors. You're saying, so what? If you happen to have a company where institutional investors were not the marginal investors, then in a sense, when you use betas and you came up with a cost of equity and a cost of capital, there should be a caveat added to those numbers saying these numbers are probably too low to use internally in the company, because the people making decisions in this company are going to be looking at investors who set prices, and those investors are not diversified. Maybe they'll start expanding the way they think about risk to include total risk. So I'm not saying you should use a total beta, but at least you open the door to going from a traditional market beta to a total beta. Then once you made that decision that the marginal investor was diversified, then we talked about estimating the cost of equity. And we spent probably, 4 weeks on this or 3 weeks? We started with the risk-free rate. And the first thing we specified about the risk-free rate is it's currency-specific. There is no one risk-free rate globally. There's a risk-free rate in U.S. dollars, a risk-free rate in yen, a risk-free rate in pesos, a risk-free rate in reais. And here are the two criteria for something to be risk-free. First, it has to be long-term. Why? Because valuation, corporate finance is long-term. The second, it has to be default-free. The default-free component is not an issue if you're looking at the U.S. T-bond rate or the German euro bond rate or the Swiss franc rate, where you can use the government bond rates as risk-free. But it becomes an issue when I ask you, what's the risk-free rate in Mexican pesos? Because there you start with the government bond rate, you take out the default spread. So that's the first piece of your cost of equity, is getting a risk-free rate. Which one you use will depend on what currency you chose to do your analysis in. At least a dozen of you were working with currencies with negative risk-free rates and was freaking you out. You kept asking me, can I switch currencies? Can I go to US dollars? I'm working in Swiss francs and this number is driving me up the wall. This is a negative number. And I said, if you want to, you can go do your analysis in dollars. Toyota, for instance, you can do it in dollars. Or you can stay with your risk-free rate and let go of the fact that it's negative. It's not a big deal. The rest of the mathematics will still work out. So that's the first component. Second, we need a beta. And before we look at ways of estimating beta, remember, beta measures only risk you cannot diversify away. It measures exposure to macroeconomic risk. And there are three decisions you make as a business that determine your beta. The first is, how discretionary is your product or service? More discretionary products and services will end up with higher betas. Luxury retailers will have higher betas than department stores, which will have higher betas than discount retailers. Second, tell me something about your cost structure. The greater the proportion of your costs that are fixed costs, the higher your beta. Why? Because it magnifies shocks to your system. Small drops in revenues will become big drops in operating income. And the third is, how much have you borrowed? What business are you in? What fixed cost structure do you have? How much have you borrowed? Those drive your beta. What does beta not capture? If you're exposed to a lawsuit, don't expect betas to go up because you're exposed to a lawsuit. If you're a biotechnology company, you're exposed to the fact that the FDA might not approve your drugs, don't expect beta to carry that weight because it's not meant to. So that's a beta. Then we got to the equity risk premium. And we talked about how U.S.-centric this approach has been historically. U.S.-centric in the sense people looked at historical data in the U.S. and came up with the risk premium, then traveled all over the world and applied that risk premium. I replaced a historical premium with an implied premium where I said, let me estimate what that premium is even for the U.S. going forward. And then I augmented that premium for risky markets by looking at the default risk in each country and adding on top of my U.S. equity risk premium. And your equity risk premium as a company should reflect where you do business, not where you're incorporated. So risk-free rate carries the weight of currency, beta carries the weight of business, and equity risk premium reflects the weight of geography. All three have a place. So I asked you for your inputs, especially in the beta. And the first thing I asked you was, how did you estimate your beta? And remember, there are two ways of estimating beta. I started with a classic textbook way, run a regression, get the slope of the line. Slope of the line is the beta. But then I pointed out what I think the problem with that beta is. First, it's backward looking by definition. Second, it's noisy. Noisy in what sense? You have that big standard error. And third, if your company has changed over the 2, 3, 5 years you're running the regression, your beta means very little. So the alternative I offered to you was that bottom-up beta approach, where you break your company down into businesses and you build up to a beta by taking a weighted average of the betas of businesses you're in. And as you wrestled with this on your project, you discovered there were layers of subjective judgments you had to make. What do you call comparable? What businesses are you going to look at? And that doesn't mean we all agree. So the fact that we use bottom-up betas doesn't mean we're going to end up with the same beta for the same company, but we have a different process. So one of the questions I asked you was, what beta did you get? What approach did you use to get your beta? So here's what you told me. Do you think there was a bias in how I presented betas? Was I pushing you towards one? I didn't think I was that pushy, was I? Yeah. But the pushiness worked, I guess, because of the 500 groups, 95% said they used bottom-up betas. 4% used regression betas. One of these days, this pie chart is going to be one color. I'm going to keep working at it, but there's still a 4% holdout there. And 1%, of course, did neither B nor R, they had C, S, T. I have no idea what those things all mean. So again, either you have a secret meaning or you were just too exhausted at the right key. Now, I haven't read your reports, but if you used a regression beta, I can safely predict that you use one of the three arguments that you will see listed below. The first is that your company was so unique you could not find other companies like it. And I'll cut you some slack. Maybe you have a unique company, but you have to tell me what's unique about the company. Remember, companies can be unique in the product or service they offer, but the way they make money might not be unique. Facebook is unique because it's a social media company. It's not unique because it makes its money on advertising. So from that perspective, it's tough for me to figure out how you truly come up with a unique business, a business that's never been tried before. The second argument you might make is my company's on only one line of business, therefore I don't need to use a bottom-up beta. That's a really weak argument. Why? What are the two arguments for bottom-up betas? One is if you're in many businesses, I can take a weighted average. But what's the bigger reason that I said you should use bottom-up betas? It was a statistical reason. It was the law of large numbers, right? So in fact, I said don't trust one regression. An average of 100 regressions will always be more precise than one regression. So if you're a steel company, I'd still rather take the average beta across 100 steel companies rather than use the beta of one steel company. There's a third reason which many of you wrestled with that I felt the afterburn on, which is you had a regression beta and a bottom-up beta. The numbers are really different. And he said, in my company, the numbers are really different. What should I do? To which my response is, if most of the time we get numbers that are pretty similar on bottom-up and regression betas, why would I waste my time doing bottom-up betas? It's because they're different that you want a second approach. And my argument is when they're different, trust the bottom-up beta, not the regression beta. So don't let the fact that they're different be a problem. That is, in fact, the reason you're picking one beta over the other. So bottom-up or regression beta. Then I asked you, what beta did you get for your company? Right? And here's what you told me you got as betas. And I'd like you to keep a running tab on all the characteristics of a typical company being analyzed in this class. What's the average beta across all companies? One. Your median beta was 1.09, your average beta was 1.13. So you are tilted towards riskier companies than the average company. File that away. So that's the first characteristic of companies in this class, is you are picking more risky companies relative to the market. Then I asked you what your Jensen's alpha was. What's the average Jensen's alpha across all companies? Zero. Your average Jensen's alpha, the average was 36. That's huge, but partly because you had some outliers. Because your Jensen's alpha can be huge for a company. If you have Tesla, for instance, your Jensen's alpha can be 60, 70, 80%. The median was 2.5%, but it was still different from zero. Yep.
So would you hire the class as a whole?
No, but there's a reason why the Jensen's alpha. I mean, I'll come to your donkey problem too afterwards, but there's a reason why your Jensen's alpha was positive, and it had something to do with what I forced you to do. What did I said no money-losing companies up front, right? So already I've tilted you. There's a reason. This Jensen's alpha has been positive every single time I've taught this class, because at the start of the class in corporate finance, I said stay away from money-losing companies. You've taken away the 30 or 35% of the sample. Okay? So your typical company is riskier than average, has a positive Jensen's alpha. It's done better than the typical company. Then I ask you what your R-squared is. Your median R-squared was 21%. Your average R-squared was 25%. The typical R-squared for the market right now is 30 to 35%. So let's sum up. Your company is riskier than the typical company in the market, has done better than the typical company in the market, also gets less of its risk from market forces. Why do you think that is? What kinds of companies were you attracted to? To do boring companies, you want to go and do something. Pandora, you want. I think you know. You guys must like food a lot, because food companies were by far the most. I think a third of the companies were like Chipotle. You know, basically, you went from eating place to eating place. Either you were sampling the food from your companies excessively, or you were kind of stuck in there. It was Netflix, Krispy Kreme, and Chipotle. Basically, you know, you were just going for the trifecta in one. You know. But you were attracted to companies which were more exciting, right? Who wants to do a boring company? That gets reflected. Exciting companies tend to have lower R-squares because much of the risk is firm-specific. So again, none of this is unpredictable, but it's interesting to see how your selection can drive your end results. So we have a cost of equity, risk-free rate plus beta times equity risk premium. We have a cost of equity, right? That cost of equity goes into cost of capital. Let's see what you need to get from cost of equity to cost of capital. You need a cost of debt. Somebody remind me again what the cost of debt is supposed to measure. What are we trying to capture in the cost of debt? Griffin? Cost of borrowing, complete the story. Long term or short term? Long term. Cost of borrowing, long term. Historically or today? Today. Cost of borrowing money, long term, today. Cost of borrowing money, long term, today. Keep repeating that to yourself because it simplifies your life. Why does it simplify your life? You don't care about the rate at which you borrowed it 2 years ago, 5 years ago. To get your cost of debt, all you need to do is take your risk-free rate, which is long-term, and add on top of that a default spread. That's what the cost of debt boiled down to. How much that default spread was easier to compute for some of your companies than others. For some of your companies, you had a third party tell you how much default risk there was in the company, and Moody's or an S&P bond rating for the company. You use that to come up with a default spread. But for about two-thirds of the companies picked in this class, there was no bond rating available. So you had to estimate a synthetic rating, and that required a little bit of gymnastics. You had to go through that interest coverage ratio, the lookup table, and that process got a little messy, as you noticed, if you have leases. And you can see why, right? If you have leases, because it's not counted as interest, so it's especially the case for those of you who had no conventional debt and lots of leases. Because if you have no conventional debt, what does your income statement give you as interest expense? Zero. You divide the operating income by zero, what do you get? Come on, this is pure math. Infinity. You look for infinity on that lookup table, what rating do you give the company? AAA. And then you say, that can't be true. And of course, it is not true. The reason is your leases are acting like debt. The ratings agency, if they were rating this company, would definitely not give it a AAA rating. The problem, though, is it's chicken and the egg problem, right? You need the synthetic rating to get a cost of debt. You need the cost of debt to convert leases to debt, and you need the debt to compute an interest expense. And you might not have realized this. My spreadsheet, my rating spreadsheet does that for you. That's why you have the iteration box checked off. But if you're doing it manually, this is obviously a problem you ran into. You either overcame it or you did not overcome it, but you came up with a synthetic rating for your company, came up with a default spread, and then you multiplied your cost of debt by 1 minus the tax rate. And remind me again what tax rate I should be using? Marginal tax rate. Why? Because interest saves you taxes at the margin. Make that almost a mantra. Every time somebody asks you, why do you use a marginal tax? Because interest saves you tax. You might have no idea what you're actually saying, but it sounds so good. Interest saves you tax. But really what you're saying is, if I have $100 in income and $10 in interest expense, I save on the last $10, not the first 10 or the middle 10. So that's your cost of debt. The weights that you attach to debt and equity should be market value weights. For equity, that's usually share price times number of shares, right? Just remember to count all the multiple classes of shares you have as a company. For debt, it was a little messier again. You had book value of debt that you'd convert to market value, which required a maturity for the debt. For some of your companies, you could get a maturity. For some of your companies, it was not available. My suggestion, if you don't have a maturity for the debt, put a zero maturity, which means your market value and your book value are going to become the same. Move on. It's not really worth the effort of trying to finish. I mean, one of the things you have to realize is when to fight the data and when to give in. The data is the data. If you don't have the data, there's no point beating yourself up saying, I wish I had the maturity, I wish I had the lease commitments. You don't. Nothing you can do about it. Make your best assumption and move on. So that's my cost of capital. And let's see what you found as debt ratios for your company. Your median debt ratio was about 22%, and your average was around 24%. Yes, Mary. Yeah. Your market value will just become the book. It will mess up your weights only if your true market value is different. So even if you'd put a maturity of 5 years, when does market value become different from book value? So only if your book interest rate and your market interest rate are different. So just using a longer maturity doesn't give you different numbers, right? So debt is a little tricky. It's not as if using a longer maturity makes the market value lower. It depends on what your interest expense is. So that's why I would not spend too much time fighting that maturity number, because ultimately, unless you have a company like Valiant, which has gone from triple B down to B plus in a 6 month period, you can let go. It's not going to make that much of a difference, right? So your median debt ratio is about 20%. So your typical company, in addition to being riskier than the average company, doing better than the average company, having less of its risk come from the market than the average company, also tends to have less debt than the typical company. Okay. We'll come back and talk about whether that's okay or not, because I asked you for the optimal debt ratio as well, but these were the actual debt ratios. Now, once you get the cost of capital and the cost of equity, they become hurdle rates, right? You say, what the heck does that mean? By this point in time, you know what hurdle rates are. They're what you need to make to break even. And for your company, since you could not go within the company and look at individual projects, that data is not available to us from the outside, I asked you to take a snapshot of the company, kind of a rough measure of whether your company was taking good projects or not, by looking at the accounting numbers. Accounting numbers in what sense? I said, take the after-tax operating income, which is the income you make as a company, and divide it by the invested capital in the company, which is book value of equity plus book value of debt minus cash. It's the only place in this entire project where book values come into play. With all their warts, and some of you had to run into them, you come up with a return on capital. You compare the return on capital to the cost of capital, at least in a very rough measure. If that return on capital exceeds the cost of capital, your company is taking good projects. If it's roughly equal, your company is breaking even. If it's lower, it's doing worse. Do you remember I showed you the distribution for the global companies? What percentage of companies earn less than the cost of capital? 55% of companies globally last year earned less than the cost of capital. File that away, because I'm going to show you what you found on your companies, but you're comparing the return on capital to the cost of capital. You could also wear your equity hat. If you're wearing your equity hat, everything becomes equity focused. Your earnings become net income rather than after-tax operating income. The investment you make in the company becomes book equity rather than invested capital. You divide net income by book equity, you come up with a return on equity. And some of you noticed a practical problem that you ran into, which is your book equity can become negative. There are at least probably 25 companies in this class where book equity was negative. How does book equity become negative? You keep losing money, your book equity will hit zero and keep going. And if your book equity is negative, you can't compute the return on equity. You can still compute a return on invested capital, but you get a not meaningful number for the book equity.
Why don't we look at IRR?
To get IRR, what do you need? No, the discount rate is not what you need. IRR, you don't need a discount rate. And how do you, what do you have to NPV? Expected cash flows on a project. How the hell are you going to get them, right? You're doing Netflix. All you have is a collection of numbers for the entire company. So you don't have the luxury when you're sitting on the outside looking at a company saying, I'd like to know the IRR. Everybody would. But since we don't have the insides of the company, we're using the accounting numbers to get a measure from the outside. So that's why it's a rough proxy, because you'd like to see the cash flows, you'd like to see the time value, but you don't have that information with you. So you compare the return equity to the cost of equity. So let's see what you found. Remember what I said, 55% of companies globally earn less than their cost of capital, right? Your median company earned about 13% more than its hurdle rate, both in terms of cost of equity and cost of capital. I'm sorry, your average company. Your median company earned about 9% more than its cost of equity, and about 6% more than its cost of capital. Again, this is a little bit of the tilt that I've introduced, because I've steered you away from money-losing companies, and then you went for exciting companies, which tend to be companies that have done well. Not surprisingly, that selection bias plays out in the excess returns you found. Right? And then we got to the capital structure section. I said, how much? Remember, I showed you the actual debt ratios. I asked you to compute the optimal. So you plug numbers into the spreadsheet, you played around, you came up with an optimal debt ratio. Your median optimal debt ratio across all of your companies was 40%. Remember that banker I talked about who said, can I use 40% safely as a debt ratio? Maybe he was right. Yeah. It was, the median is about 40%. There are 8 companies that you told me your optimal is 90%. And there were at least 65 companies with the optimal debt ratio was 0% across the 500. You're saying, how can that be? Well, if you have really low operating income relative to your value, it's not the dollar value of your operating income. You take a Netflix. Does it make money? It makes money. But relative to what? For instance, Facebook makes money, but it has a market cap of $220 billion, so it's that relative number that drives the optimal. So if you have a young growth company, or even an older growth company, don't be surprised to see really low optimal debt ratios, because you get to 10% of $220 billion, that's $22 billion in debt. That's a lot of debt. You might not be able to get to that debt level. So when you have young growth companies with low cash flows or low operating income relative to the market value, it's exactly what you should see. So if you found an optimal of 0% for your company, you have lots of company. Lots of people in this, the classes collectively found that optimal. Now, I compared your actual to your optimal for each company. That's why I asked for each of you to send me those numbers. And your typical company was underlevered by about 10%. Not huge, but no. So it's, there was one company that was underlevered by 90%. I won't name the company because I don't think these numbers really make sense for that company. But I'll be interested to see this project report when it does come, because something is gone haywire somewhere, right? Because their actual zero, the optimal is 90%. You either have screwed up or this is the greatest LBO target of all time, right? So if you're the person who did this company, don't try to fix your report. It's too late now. Just let it go, right? No. But something, you either got a decimal point in the wrong place or something went a little haywire, right? But there was one company which had an optimal debt ratio which was 68% lower. It was tremendously over-levered. And that company, actually, the name made sense, that they were over-levered. I don't know whether they're over-levered by this much, but clearly they were significantly over-levered. So I asked you the actual and the optimal. Then I asked you, what kind of debt should your company take? And again, I said, start with intuition. What's a typical project for your company? And I know you wrestle with this question. You're saying, what's a typical project for Facebook? And that's a tough question, right? What is a typical project for Facebook? Did any of you read the news over the last, I think it was Thursday or Friday, where Mark Zuckerberg talked about how much time he would like people to spend on Facebook? Right now, I think, an American spends 59 minutes every day, 59 minutes every day on Facebook. And Zuckerberg said, that's not enough. We have to be spending at least, we have to get people to spend at least 2 hours a day. Scary thought on Facebook. So you can see how his mind is working. We have to get more links. We have to get more news, more entertainment on Facebook. He sees Facebook as competition, not just for your grandmother that you no longer call, that you Facebook instead. Those of you who Facebooked your mother yesterday, you will burn in bad places, no? So, but hopefully you did the right thing and you don't blame me. This is another thing I don't want to carry on my shoulders. If you said this Demodaran guy gave us a project, I couldn't call you on Saturday. No. That's not going to work for me. But if you're looking at Facebook, he's looking at what can I add on. Instagram was a Facebook investment. That's the kind of investment you're thinking about. What is this company thinking about doing to expand its business? And that'll then give you some insight into what kind of investment. And I said, match up the debt to your investment. I did go that quantitative route where I looked at a history of what's your firm value done, what's your operating income done over time, and I ran regressions against macro variables. Remember those? Where I regressed the firm value against changes in interest rates, and the coefficient told me what the duration of the assets was. I regressed your firm value and operating income against GDP, and the coefficient told me how cyclical you were as a company. The more cyclical you were, the more sensitive you were to GDP changes. I ran regressions against the weighted dollar, and the coefficient there told me how much the dollar strengthening or weakening hurt your numbers. And I also ran a regression against inflation, where the coefficient told me what your pricing power was. And then I connected it all to what I thought Disney's actual debt should be, and then I looked at what they actually had. Some of you did try these regressions, and as you probably found out, the numbers can be all over the place. The coefficients can be crazy. And I said, just let it go, because it's small regressions, lots of noise in the variables. Either use a bottom-up, where you look at the SIC code of your company, or just give me an intuitive analysis of what your company should be borrowing. Okay? And then we got to the dividend section. And the key to the dividend section was the notion of free cash flow at equity. And don't let that become a buzzword. It's really potential dividend. It's what's left over after you've met every conceivable need. So here's the way to think about it. Start with what you as equity investors get out of the company, which is net income. Add back depreciation and amortization. Why? Because they're accounting expenses but not cash expenses. Subtract out what you have to reinvest to keep this company going in capital expenditures and working capital. If you have debt payments, make those debt payments. If you have preferred dividends to pay, make those payments. And if you're borrowing money, think of that as cash inflow to the company. What you're left with is a free cash reduction. So I was checking your 500 free cash flows to equity, and in, I think, 83 companies, the free cash flow to equity was negative. Assuming that this is an average across 3 or 4 or 5 years, which is what I asked for, that would basically mean that these companies should not be paying dividends. So I checked the dividends, and in half of those companies with negative free cash flows to equity, you were actually seeing cash being paid out by the company. So your dividend section should have become very simple. You have negative free cash flow to equity, you're paying out cash. You either are an under-levered company that's using this to move towards your optimal, which would make sense, or you just are stuck on a dividend policy you can't afford anymore, but you can't let go. So I asked you what your dividends and free cash flow equity, dividends and buybacks were as a percentage of the free cash flow equity. So basically, I asked you for the two numbers separately, but I computed my own ratio. And this is actually a very strange distribution, right? It's like two peaks at either end. And that reflects the dysfunctionality of dividend policy, which is you have extremes. At one extreme, you have lots of companies that don't pay any cash out to the stockholders. You have almost 80 companies. At the other end of the spectrum, you have 156 companies that pay out more in dividends and buybacks than they have available as free cash or equity. So about 30% of your companies are paying out way too much. Maybe 10% are paying exactly what they should, and 60% are holding back cash. Last part of this project, and this was a little unfair because in a sense you don't have enough of a foundation to really feel comfortable doing valuation right now, and I'll show you where it's going to get reflected, and I'll show you in numbers. But I kind of put in valuation at the very end of the class because it brings together the end game, which is in corporate finance is to maximize value. And I said when you sit down to value something, make up your mind what you value. You can either value the equity or you can value the business. If you decide to value equity, everything you do has to be equity focused, starting with cash flows to equity, which are cash flows left over after debt payments, or if you want to be lazy, dividends. You have to look at growth in equity earnings, which is going to come from what's your return equity and how much you reinvest back in the company, the retention ratio. Your discount rate has to be a cost of equity, and what you get as a present value will be a value of equity. Or you can wear those take an expensive approach, value the entire business, where you take cash flows before debt payments. So you start with operating income rather than net income. You subtract out reinvestment, not debt payments. You get cash flow to the firm. Your growth is going to be growth in operating income, not net income. So you look at how much you reinvest as a percentage of operating income and how well you reinvest as the return on capital. Your discount rate has to be the cost of capital. What you get as a present value will be the value of the entire business. Make up your mind right at the start. And for many of you, I made up your mind for you by forcing you down the firm valuation route with that FCFF. And I did it because as you get more comfortable with valuation, you can start doing it. But when you first start doing valuation, it's safer to value businesses rather than valuing equity because mistakes don't have big effects. So because small mistakes can translate into big effects in equity value. So here's the way to think about the present value number you get after you discount cash flows. I'll start easy. If you're taking expected dividends per share on a stock, discounting the back of the cost of equity, what do you get as a present value? You're done. That's your value per share. You can stop. If you're discounting aggregate free cash flow equity for the entire company, which you got from the dividend section, you're discounting those free cash flow equity, the cost of equity, what you valued is the total equity in this company, which then gets divvied up between the common stockholders and people who own options of the company. Remember, when you own options of the company, you own a piece of the equity, so you have to separate the two. If you're discounting free cash flows to the firm at the cost of capital, which is what you're doing in the FCFF Simple Ginsu spreadsheet, what you get as a present value is just the value of the operating assets. Why just the operating assets? Because what did we start off as our measure of income? Operating income. Only those assets that are part of operating income have been valued. What hasn't been valued yet? First, you haven't valued cash and marketable securities. So in the case of Apple, don't forget that $220 billion that you've left on the table. You've got to add them back. You also haven't valued cross holdings in other companies. In the case of Yahoo, you haven't valued Yahoo Japan and Alibaba. Why? They're minority holdings in other companies. That was the box in the FF Simple Ginzel spreadsheet where it said, are there other non-operating assets? That was not meant for things like goodwill and stuff. You can't throw stuff in there and double count. It's for things you haven't counted yet. So essentially, that's for cross holdings in other companies. So you add that back. Then you subtract out debt. And then there's one final roadblock you have to get through that I'm not going to hold you on this class on. But if you own 60% of another company, what are you required to do in accounting? You're required to consolidate. What does that even mean, Felipe? You have to, it's not just that your statements have to come together. You have to act like you own 100% of the subsidiary. I've never understood this. So you tell the accountant, but I own only 60%. He says, don't worry about it. Act like you own 100%. So you do. Then you get to the balance sheet and you count 100% of the assets. And you say, I own only 60%. Don't worry about it. And then at the last moment, he wakes up and says, you own only 60%. I said, that's what I've been trying to tell you all this time. You don't own 40%. Eureka. We have to show the 40% that doesn't belong to you somewhere. You know what that item is called? Minority interest. Minority holdings are small pieces of other companies. Your minority interests are pieces of companies you've acted like you own, but you don't. Why else do you think it's on the liability side of the balance sheet? As I said, I'm not going to hold you to that issue on this particular valuation, but that's why I asked you for minority interest, because I need to subtract that out to get to the value of equity in a company. Cross holdings are the biggest problem in valuation, because valuing those correctly requires that you navigate whether it's a minority holding or a minority interest, and how you value it can be different. Ashley? Minority holding are small pieces of other companies you own, but because they're minority holdings, accountants don't treat them as part of operating income. If you own 60%, you've already counted 100%. Here's what will happen. If you own 60%, because it's consolidated and you used operating income for your company, your operating income already has 100% of the subsidiary in it already. That's the problem. You own only 60%. That's why you're subtracting out the minority interest, saying, I've counted too much. I own only 60%. That's why minority holdings get added on, because it never got part of your operating income. Minority interest gets subtracted out because you overcounted what's in your operating income. You come to a value of equity, subtract out the options, you get a value per share. So let me actually finish my Disney valuation, because I never got to this in my last class, because it kind of brings all these pieces together. So here's what I did to value Disney. I gave it a 10-year growth period. And remember the rationale I gave for why I'm giving it a 10-year growth period? It's not a very high growth rate, but I said it's substantial competitive advantage in barriers to entry. So I'm going to let it grow for 10 years. I'm going to do a status quo valuation of Disney. What does it mean? I'm going to value Disney as if it's going to be continue to be run by the existing management, which is probably realistic. Bob Iger is going to continue to run it, and the people he picks will continue to run it. So for the first 5 years, here's what I gave Disney. I gave its existing numbers, its existing cost of capital, its existing debt ratio, its existing return on capital, its existing reinvestment rate, on the assumption that if they kept doing what they were doing, that's what they would deliver. So their existing debt ratio is only 11.6%. You're saying, but we computed an optimal of 40%. This is not your company. Don't go around changing things just because you feel like it. That's why it's a status quo valuation. It uses the existing debt ratio and the existing cost of capital. Beyond year 10, I made Disney a mature company. Somebody remind me again, what are the characteristics of mature companies? First, their growth rate is less than or equal to the growth rate of the economy, which I use the risk-free rate as my proxy, so I bring the growth rate down. But I'm not quite done. So I brought the growth rate down. What else do I have to change if it's a mature company? My beta will start to move towards one. My cost of capital will converge on that of a mature company. My cost of capital will probably get smaller. What else? My return on capital, which might be great right now because I'm a growth company, will start to move towards my cost of capital. Roy, anything else? So my cost of capital will start to move towards a mature company. My growth rate will drop, and my return on capital decrease. And I did all of that for Disney. My growth rate became 2.5%, lower than my risk-free rate. My cost of capital came down to 7.29%, lower than what it is now because it's a mature company, and I brought the return on capital down to 10%. So in year 11, my company becomes a mature company in all of its facets. So years one through five, the company continues to be run as is. Year 11, it becomes a mature company. You're saying, what about years six through 10? Whenever I do valuation, I want to make my life as easy as I can. In fact, this is true for everything in my life, but in valuation, it's particularly true. And the last thing I want to be doing in valuation is estimating year six, year seven, year eight, year nine, and year 10, because I have no idea what's going to happen. So I look for a way I could put that on autopilot. Let's see if you can guess what I did. My growth rate for the next 5 years, I've assumed to be 6.8%. My growth rate in year 11, I've assumed to be 2.5%. I want year 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. What do you think I did in year 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10? I took 6.8 and 2.5. I took the difference. I divided by 5. I bang, bang, bang. I said, that is so unsophisticated. Guilty as charged. And if you have a better way of finessing those numbers, be my guest. So basically, so that's what the transition, CO 6 through 10 is there for one reason and one reason alone, to adjust my numbers from where they are now to where I'd like them to be. And what you're going to see on the next page is the end result of these assumptions. And as you look at this page, you're actually seeing this entire class play out on one page. Everything we've talked about is on this page. This is my valuation of Disney. Let me lead you through the process. I've given Disney a growth rate of 6.8%. Let me take that back. Disney has earned a growth rate of 6.8% by doing what? By reinvesting 54% and earning a return on capital of 12.6%. So that section 5 where I looked at the return on capital, that's helping me here because it's giving me the growth rate. The cost of capital I have for Disney right now is 7.81%. You start. I used a risk-free rate of 2.75%. Why? Because I'm doing a valuation in US dollars and I used the T-bond rate then. I used a beta 1.011, reflecting the fact that Disney is in five businesses, the bottom up beta. So it's basically I'm stealing from that part of the analysis. I used an equity risk premium of 5.76%, reflecting the fact that Disney gets 82% of its revenues in the US. So if somebody at Disney doesn't like my cost of equity, you know what I'm going to ask them? What are you going to do differently? Are you going to go into different parts of the world? Are you going to change businesses? You obviously can't do much about the risk-free rate. So essentially what I'm doing is creating a shield for myself on these numbers, because if somebody says, why are you using that growth rate? I'm going to turn it back on them and say, what do you plan to do differently? The cost of debt, I used the actual rating for Disney. It was a single A rated company that gave me a default spread of 1%. I did use the marginal tax rate that Disney gave me for their, which is like 36.1%. My cost of debt. The weights are the current debt weights. Again, why? Because Bob Iger is running the company. This is a status quo valuation. The status quo value that I get for Disney as a company, if I discount those cash flows back, is $125.48 billion. That's the present value of the cash flows, including the big terminal value number. I add cash, $39.31. I had 2.849 non-operating investment. So what does that tell you? They must have a minority holding in something, right? You know what that is? You know what percentage of Hong Kong Disney actually owns? It's 49%. Why 49%? Not because Disney did not want to own 100%, but because the Chinese government actually required them to own less than a majority stake. Because it's 49%, it's not consolidated into the financials. So when you computed the operating income for Disney, you haven't counted any of Hong Kong Disney. That is my estimate of the value of Hong Kong Disney, $2.85 billion. I subtract out debt. Then I subtract out minority interest. What does that tell you? That Disney probably has 60%. In fact, it owns a couple of Indian TV companies and other holdings where they own more than 50%. They're consolidated. That minority interest reflects the portion of those companies they don't own. I subtract that out. I get a value for the equity. I subtract out management options, which Disney has granted to its managers. I get a value per share of $62.56. But the number reflects all of the different pieces that we've kind of put together in the puzzle. In fact, I could probably teach this class backwards. Don't worry, I'm not planning. But this page as the anchor, where everything we do in the class can go back to one box on this. Investment analysis, capital structure, dividend policy, it's all in there. So I asked you for your value in price, right? So spring 2016, that's your collective finding. Your average company was overvalued by about 63%, but that's because you had some really overvalued companies. Your median was about 10% above value. About 70% of you were clustered right around the market price. And that's almost always going to be the case in a class like this. You know why? Because that's the safest place for you to be. Let's face it. The value you were going to send me was not the first valuation you did. You came up with like 12. The stock was like 55. You said, this can't be right. And then you went to tweak things. I won't even ask you why. I'll leave all the making of the sausage in the kitchen. But you tried a slightly higher revenue growth. Then after a while, you figured out. So that's part of the thing is when you first start doing this, you discover the levers that work and the levers that don't. You're saying some things and nothing changes. You say, oh, it changes a lot. Oh, that's a variable. I'll go change that. Yeah. So it's natural. When you first start doing valuation, the market price is going to act like a magnet saying, come on over, come on over. And you're just going to go over to it. It's only as you get more confident that you're going to start to see these numbers diverge. When I teach my valuation class, now I make people do valuations every week, and each week you'll see the divergence start to get larger. Initially, they'll all cluster around my valuations, because that way they say, look, if you screwed up, we all screwed up. And by the 6th, 8th, 10th week, they're, you know, and that's part of the process of getting more comfortable. So don't kind of beat yourself up. It's natural to kind of move towards a market price. The reason I show this graph is to show you that if you're looking for massive insights about the future based on this distribution, let it go. See spring of 2008? That was just before the crisis, right? What if this class was so incredibly insightful that in spring of 2008, 100% of companies had come out as overvalued? That would be great, right? Because we could just start a mutual fund right with the class and, you know. The reality is they didn't see it coming, so at this stage at least you have no great forecasting ability. And maybe at any stage in your life that's not going to come, so don't, again, blame yourself. So let's ask this final piece. So if you look at the drivers of value, it's cash flows, growth, cost of capital, and when will you be a mature company? When I think about restructuring a company, I think about those four basic inputs. Because when you... But let's say you're hired as a CEO of a company. The first thing you do is look at the existing cash flow and say, what can I do to improve those cash flows? Can I run the company more efficiently? Can I cut costs? Then you look at growth and say, can I create more value from growth? Which can come from either reinvesting more if you have a really great return on capital, or reinvesting less if you have a really bad... So you can actually create value from growth. They're actually growing less if you're growing in all the wrong places. Okay? Cost of capital... How do you lower your cost of capital? Come on, at this stage in a corporate finance class, the answer is change your debt mix, right? That's one. What are the other ways you can lower your cost of capital? There are three other ways. Let's see if we can get at least two. You can lower your debt, you can change your debt mix. I'm sorry? You can reduce your fixed costs, right? Because that reduces your beta. What about matching debt up to your assets? Why do we do that? What does it do? It reduces the default risk for your company if you match the debt up, which grows your cost of debt. And what did I say the first variable that drove your beta was? What are the three things that you do as a company? So fixed cost is one. Discretionary. If you can make your product or service less discretionary, you've actually lowered your beta and lowered your cost of capital. It's not easy to do, but if you can convince people that they cannot live without something that they're absolutely fine without, and in a sense, it pays out for you as a lower cost of capital. And finally, when you look at when will I be a mature company, that really boils down to what kind of competitive advantages do you have as a company. Everything you do in any class at Stern is really a piece of this puzzle. In fact, if they let me do this, I'd come into every class. Not that I would like to, actually, but no, don't make to pass this offer out. I'd come into your marketing class, last class, and this is what you did in the marketing class, this is why it matters in value, because everything you do and everything in business has to show up somewhere in this picture. Now, the advantage of doing this at the very end of a corporate finance class is not only do you have a valuation, you have your own perspectives on what this company does, right? So if I take Disney, by the time I did the valuation of Disney, I had my own views on how much it should borrow. I'd done the optimal debt ratio. How much it should pay in dividends? How much should be reinvesting? So here's what I did. Remember that status quo value, which was 62.56? That was with Bob Iger running the company. I said, what if tomorrow I could run Disney? What would I do differently? Well, I did two things. One is I changed the debt ratio to 40%. Why 40%? Because that was my optimal. So I didn't just pick a number out of the air. And then I also tried a different combination of reinvestment and return. Right now, Bob Iger's reinvestment rate is 54%. He's making about a 12.61% return on capital. And maybe by reinvesting less, being more selective in their investments, and delivering a higher return. So I'm not increasing the growth rate that much, 6.8 to 7%, but it's becoming more valuable growth. With those two changes, the value that I get per share is $74.91. So let me ask you a question. The status quo value is 62.56. The value with my changes put in is $74.91, $12.35 higher. What should I call that increase in value? Where did it come from? It came from the fact that I was controlling the company, not Bob Iger, right? You'd often hear people talk about the value of control, control premiums. And people use arbitrary numbers, 20%, 30%. The value of control is very simple. It's a difference between two values, the value of your company as is and the value of the company run differently. You don't have to do this on your project. But at this stage in your project, you actually know enough about your company. And I said, if I were running the company differently, what would these numbers look like? And assuming the company is not that efficiently run, you should get a much higher value. But if you had one of those companies that was already perfectly managed and perfectly run, there's nothing you're going to be able to do to increase value. So the value control can be very small for well-managed companies, can be huge for badly managed companies. Yes, Josh. What do you mean? But if you're taking better projects, you're investing in better businesses, you're making more money, how is it not more value?
It's about how the restructuring is done.
If it's financial restructuring, with changing debt ratio, it's value creation for you, but it's coming from taxpayers. Is that what you're saying? That's not value created for the economy?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very narrow definition of what value is.
That's true. But your job is a very narrow job. Right, as a CEO, as a CEO of a company, a job. You're absolutely right. If the only way companies are creating value in a society is through just changing debt ratios, that economy is in trouble. But you know who's at fault? The people who wrote the tax code. And in a sense, that's what needs to be fixed. So what you're saying is, if you write bad tax codes, you're going to get a lot of business changes being driven by the tax code rather than by good, because what's happening above the line is good. That's what makes economies prosperous. You want to pick better businesses to invest in, generate more revenues and profits. But what happens below the line, you're right, is really a transfer of wealth from other parts of the economy to this. And that's really not good for the economy. But if you're the CEO of Apple, your job is to deliver a higher price on Apple and let somebody else have to worry about the economy, the big macroeconomic issues. So if you got a value different from the price, as many of you did, one of the questions that often pops up is, how do you explain the price? And the answer is very simple. At the start of the session, last session, I said there are two ways you can think about the number you attach in an asset. One is valuation, which is what we've gone through in the last two sessions. The other is you can price that asset. And I gave the example of, hey, when you buy an apartment or a house, think of how you come up with the number for the apartment or the house. You look at other transactions in the neighborhood, you put a number on it. So here's the reality. If you ask me, why is Disney priced the way it is, rather than show you an intrinsic valuation model, which is missing the point, I'm going to look at the other companies that Disney is priced relative to and what they're being priced on. So here, for instance, is Disney against other entertainment companies. I use the price-earnings ratio. Why? Because I need something which is standardized. I can't compare prices across companies. The price-earnings ratio tells me what multiple of earnings I'm willing to pay for a company. The average for the sector is about 47. Disney's actually trading at about 29.8. So if I were a really lazy equity research analyst, Here's what my equity research reported said. Buy Disney. It's cheap. Why is it cheap? It's trading at 30 times earnings. The average company trades at 48. The problem, though, is the median for this sector was about 28. Which means that so you can see why pricing, it's really how you present it. So if I wanted to convince you that something was cheap or expensive, all I have to do is find a set of comparables and a multiple that work for me. So when you see an equity research report from an investment bank, remember, what you're seeing is not valuation, it's pricing. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just be honest about the process because you're picking a multiple and comparables. So if you have to price Facebook rather than value it, here's what you'd have to do. You have to find the companies that investors are pricing Facebook relative to. I tried this about 3 years ago. You know who Facebook is being priced against, right? Other social media companies. Then you have to look at how investors are attaching prices to those companies like LinkedIn and Yelp. And so what I did was I took the market prices of all of these companies. I took a bunch of variables on these companies, revenues, EBITDA, EBIT, every conceivable thing. And then I did some statistics to see what investors were looking at by looking at the correlation between, you know, market cap and revenues. Is revenues what they're looking at? They didn't seem to care what the revenues were. They said maybe it's operating income. Didn't care. You know the variable that explained 98% of the differences in market cap across social media companies was? You tell me this variable, I can tell you what price your company will trade at. Number of users. 98% R squared. You tell me how many users you have, I'll multiply by 100 and you got your price. You think that's pretty unsophisticated. Hey, if it works, it works. Twitter at the time it went public at 240 million users. 240 million times 100 is what? 24 billion, you're done. But if you're an investment banker, you can't show that number because you've got to charge these hefty prices. So what you do is you reverse engineer a discounted cash flow valuation to make it look like you came up with 24 billion. Then you do this little kabuki dance around the 24 billion. So look, cash flow, discount rate. And while I'm distracted, you're really making me pay $100 per user. If you're pricing something, just price the damn thing. Don't play this discounted cash flow game. It's a wrong tool. It's like bringing a baseball bat to a soccer game. Actually, that's not a bad idea now that I think about it. I should tell my son, take a baseball bat. He's a defender. You could really get away with lots of stuff on the field. But that's really what pricing is, and that explains why market values and prices and value can be different. So I asked you what your most undervalued companies were. Again, big caveat, don't do anything rash with the companies on this table, or if you do, don't blame me. So these were the companies you told me were the cheapest companies to invest in. Okay? So ignore the currency signs, because obviously Sony is in yen, that's why it looks like it's a huge number. But the last column tells you how much they're undervalued if your value is trusted. I'm willing to make a deal with you. If your company is on this list, I'm willing to buy that company on one condition. You know what that condition is? I'm going to ask you a question, and the answer is going to tell me whether I should be buying. What's the question I'm going to ask you? Are you buying? And if you hedge, you dance around, you say, well, maybe next year, maybe after I find things, I'm not buying. If you don't trust your own valuation to buy it, I can't trust it either. But to the degree that your numbers actually hold up, those are your most undervalued companies. And then I did a second thing, and this I've always done, is I went through your entire list of 500 companies looking for what I call my triple whammies. So here's what these companies have, and you tell me why these companies are attractive. First, they earn well above their cost of capital. They have good projects. Second, they're under-levered. So they have good projects that are under-levered. Third, they pay out less than their free cash or equity as dividends. So they have good projects, they're under-levered, they're building up cash. And to top it all off, they're also undervalued. You think, so what? If you wanted to acquire an entire company, let's say you're an activist investor, do you see why these companies are going to look really attractive to you? You're going to get them cheap because the value is less than the price. They're under-levered, so you can borrow money against their assets. They've built up a nice cash balance for you, which you can use to service the debt. To top it all off, there are projects that continue to keep delivering. Apple shows up 4 times on that list. I just don't think you can do an acquisition of Apple, but clearly this is a list that you can watch to see how many of these companies become targets of activists along the way, because this is exactly the combination of circumstances that makes a company attractive to an acquirer. So back full circle. This is a page we started the class with. The investment principle, the financing principle, the dividend principle. The investment principle says go out and take good investments. Earn a return greater than your minimum acceptable hurdle rate. The hurdle rate should reflect the riskiness of your investments. Capture the beta with equity, default spread with debt, and the mix of debt and equity captured in the weights you attach to those and the cost of capital. The return should be based on cash flows, should be time-weighted, and should be incremental. So basically, that mantra should always drive your returns. When you look at capital structure, you want to pick the right mix, the one that minimizes your cost of capital and match the debt up to your assets. And if you cannot find investments to make your hurdle rate, give the cash back. So it's really, I mean, if you dig everything we've done in this class, basically is one of these boxes going, I mean, one of these little pieces going deeper and deeper in. But that's the end game. So I'm going to take you back to the three objectives I listed for this class and a fourth one that I kind of listed that I will get to as well. I made you three, I said there are three objectives of the class. First is to give you a sense of the big picture. Okay? And I know this is a really tough struggle because as you do corporate finance, it's so easy to get caught up in the details. And you saw this in the project, right? You got stuck in something really small, but you couldn't extricate yourself from it because you did not know how it fit. One of my suggestions to you is next time you're stuck on something, before you expend a day, 2 days, 3 days trying to elevate, kind of step back and say, why am I doing this? Where does it fit in? And the answer 90% of the time might be, it doesn't matter that much. Move on. There are bigger issues for you to deal with. So have that big picture perspective. Second, there are lots of tools we've gone through in the class, but remember, they're your tools. You should never become the spreadsheet's tool. If that happens, the power has shifted completely. So if a spreadsheet is useful, use it. If it's not useful, let it go. You have to bring your particular objectives, your perspectives into this process. And the third objective, do you remember what my third objective was? I've kind of rephrased it. I wanted to make it fun. And I know this is a particularly painful time of the semester to use that word, so I kind of avoided it. But it's really not that bad, right? And once you get past the final exam, it might be fun again, right? So keep that in mind. Couple of things. One is there will be a review session for the final tomorrow from 3 to 4 in KMEC 260, right? Which will be webcast, recorded, online. So you know, if you can't make it, not a big deal. The final exam itself is from 4 to 6, or give or take a few minutes, I think, at the end. But I think I'm going to try to make it 4 to 6 so we get the 2 hours fully on Wednesday in this room, right? And the projects, as they start getting graded, will come back to you in the same sequence you sent them to me with the blind. So just like your case, you'll get your project back. So as they get graded, you should start to see them. The final grade you won't get till, obviously, the final exam is done. I get the scores together. It's going to go. One final thing. How many of you did not do your CFEs? Tell me the truth. The cost you bear is actually fairly small. The MBAs, if they don't do their CFEs, can't see their grade. So I beg them. It's a selfish, because if they don't see their grade, guess who gets emailed? I do, so I beg them. And the one thing I want to say about the CFEs, and this is going to be the last thing, is I remember the first class I ever taught was 1984, fall of 1984. It was a class at UC Berkeley called, it's BA 130. It was an introductory corporate finance class. First time I'd ever taught a class, I was just terrified. I don't know. And I wanted to find out what I did was I was waiting for the CFEs. And at those days, I actually used to fill it out on the last day of class physically with a pencil, you know, and write comments. So I go through the 150 people in the class, and most of the comments are give less homework, do this, do that. You know. And then I get to my favorite CFE of all time. This is UC Berkeley, 1984. Keep that in mind when I tell you what the CFE said. It said, wear more earth tones. I didn't even know what an earth tone was. And then I found out and I said, I'm an earth tone. If I wear earth tones, you won't even be able to see me in the background. But I haven't taken that advice too hard since. But two other things I want to say. One is, obviously, this is the last class. The review session doesn't count. I will be, and this is an unusual two-year period, is I will be teaching an undergraduate valuation class next spring, which I haven't done ever. So it will be a year from now. So if you want to come back to be tortured, you're welcome to come back. No. But I will see you at the review session, but or definitely the exam.
Spring, not to the fall.